I'm Brenda Power, and this is The Media Show. In this episode, after the Reynolds Report, how does RTE rebuild trust?
Admitting failure and learning from it and taking the public criticism that goes with it is the first stage.
John Horgan says there's a blurring of the line between opinion and fact.
I find myself a little bit uneasy with news with attitude, or to put it less mildly, attack journalism.
We're inside local radio, and how is RTE 2FM coping without Gerry Ryan?
Something like 70 or 80,000 people stopped listening to any radio once Gerry died.
But first, Regan Hutchins has been home in West Cork to spend some time in the Southern Star newspaper in Skibbereen and to see how a local paper is coping with digital. He's been chatting to the editor, Con Downing.
The Southern Star has been in existence since 1889, and actually we'll be celebrating our 125th anniversary in 2014. We would regard ourselves as the trusted source of news, views and especially sport in the area.
Philip O'Regan, you're the digital editor of the Southern Star, and you've got plans for the digital future of the paper.
I think we're probably one of the first locally owned regional newspapers to appoint a full-time digital editor. It's bridging a gap between print and digital, and it'll lead to the transition to a fully integrated multi-platform media hub for West Cork.
What kind of digital life is the newspaper going to have?
It will put in place a structure that will allow it to work across all platforms. I mean, what the Southern Star has done for so long is that it has provided news and information to the people of West Cork, and a strong, independent news provider is essential to this part of the world. And now we're bringing that to the next stage. And we're also very conscious of the huge diaspora from West Cork that's now living abroad. And part of the project will be to bring that diaspora all the news and all the information that they want from West Cork and from home.
And that was Regan Hutchins there at the Southern Star. Now, a week on from the Reynolds Report, RTE has yet to convince the Minister for Communications and the licence payers that it is deserving of public trust. The RTE board was summoned to meet with the minister first thing last Tuesday morning, and this is what he had to say later.
I'm satisfied that the board understands fully and comprehensively the gravity of what has happened, and I'm satisfied that the board is determined that the expert recommendation set out both by Professor Hogan and by the BAI will be implemented.
The minister mentioned Professor John Horgan there, the press ombudsman, who carried out an internal inquiry on guidelines and standards following that libel settlement with Father Reynolds. And that study was also published last weekend. Now, for John Horgan, one of the key issues raised by this case is a blurring of the line between opinion and fact, something which he sees as a trend across journalism in general.
The old-fashioned forms of journalism tended to separate news and comment rather more rigidly than they have been separated in recent times. Perhaps I'm just old-fashioned, but I find myself a little bit uneasy sometimes with what I would describe as news with attitude, to put it mildly, or to put it less mildly, attack journalism. Now, I'm all in favour of journalists having opinions and expressing them, and lively, combative, controversial journalism is really something that we would be very much poorer without. But if there's nothing else, it seems to me to give the impression of serving their audiences with pre-digested opinions about people and about issues. And I'm not sure that that's entirely the best thing.
Do you think that was an element in what Anna Carraher identified as groupthink in relation to Reynolds?
Where you have groups of people and teams of people working on projects, it's terribly important that there should be a point, maybe just before the team is finally committed to the project, where everybody can sit down around a table and say, look, let's imagine ourselves in the situation 12 months from now where this was a total disaster. Imagine why it became a total disaster. And that gives members of the team the possibility to raise any and every criticism without feeling that they're being in any way disloyal to the thrust of the programme, to the general spirit of inquiry and investigation that animates the team and so on. Because it's the loyalty thing. It tends to cover a multitude when it should be perhaps examined a bit more closely sometimes. Most editorial systems do work like this most of the time. But as I said in my RTE report, there is absolutely no system that is proof against mistakes. Mistakes will happen, and sometimes they will be big ones, and you just pray that the ones that you make aren't going to be big ones with the kind of consequences that the Father Reynolds thing had for RTE. I think history shows that when something like this happens in any organisation, there is an immediate chilling effect. I mean, it happened after the sacking of the authority in 1972, and it was probably happened after any big legal action, particularly in any newspaper or any media organisation, this chilling effect happens. I just hope that in the case of RTE, it won't be unduly pronounced or unduly lengthy, because RTE is one of the few organisations with the resources to put into investigative reporting. And that, coupled with its statutory requirements to be fair and so on, is a huge public protection that I would like to see not endangered in any serious way or for any great length of time.
Investigative journalism is obviously a very expensive undertaking. As a consequence of what happened here, are we not piling layer upon layer of disincentive on investigative journalism, which has brought about fantastic revelations that were required in our society? Is it not going to be more difficult?
It's a balancing act. And when I started to write my report, I was extremely conscious, and I think Anna Carraher was very conscious of this as well, of the need to avoid the over-bureaucratization of the journalism function. And in big organizations, want to play safe, the tendency is to bureaucratize, and I think that does have to be kept in check.
I see RT has undertaken to retrain 600 staff in line with your guidelines by the end of May. I mean, to what extent is there a danger that that may be just ticking the boxes rather than achieving any genuine understanding of what actually went wrong here?
Anything is better than nothing. A couple of hours of familiarisation with the guidelines is better than nothing, but it's not the answer to the problem. You're talking about the culture of a station here, and I think culture comes from the very top, right down to the bottom. If it doesn't start at the top and it doesn't permeate the organisation from the top, no amount of training at the bottom will help it to take root.
We talk about regulatory unity. You know, when you have print, broadcast, all generally ending up online, do we not need one overall regulatory authority?
There is, at least in theory, the possibility of a regulatory or a professional practice body for journalism and news-related media, because that is where issues of bias and balance and impartiality do come to the fore, much more so than in other areas where there's a bigger entertainment quotient and these issues aren't quite so important. In theory, there's no reason why there shouldn't be. In practice, there are lots of obstacles that would have to be overcome. Even if we can't achieve some kind of common basis for content regulation, at least begin to share the values and the principles that we think are important right across the field.
And that was John Horgan, the press ombudsman there. Now, John Horgan's emphasis on training is something that resonates with Pat Lockery, a BBC veteran and a former BBC board member. And the BBC has had its own share of problems, including the Jonathan Ross prank call episode, and before that, the fallout from the Hutton inquiry. So Pat has had first-hand experience of surviving and of learning from this sort of meltdown. So I asked him how he believed organisations like RTE regain public trust.
Well, firstly, humility. Admitting failure and learning from it and taking the public criticism that goes with it is the first stage. Secondly, training. You cannot expect people to do what is expected if you don't show them how to do it and spend a lot of time changing working practice to avoid any repetition of the failure. There were weeks and months of training throughout the entire staff of the BBC at every level to ensure that that concept of public trust was seen to be in the hands of everyone who worked for the organisation and that all of us played a part in it. Then making sure that guidelines are explicit, clear and up to date.
Now, RTE has suggested that retraining of 600 staff will be completed by the end of this month. Does that sound to you thorough enough?
No. That's phase one. That's the communication. But then the most effective form of journalistic training I've ever seen was hypotheticals, case studies with people of real or imagined events, just to check that the learning is appropriate. And every editor has a pedagogic function, has a role in teaching and training. And that too needs to be explicit in their job descriptions. In my experience, that crisis can be turned into an asset in a relatively short time. And we did genuinely believe in the BBC on the back of the Kelly Hutton affair that irreparable damage might have been done. We were genuinely scared of that. I think if you took a poll of public opinion today, the BBC would be found to have overcome those problems.
And that was Pat Lockery, former head of Nations and Regions for the BBC and now Vice-Chancellor of Goldsmith University. John Horgan and Pat Lockery's emphasis on training presents a challenge for RTE. Training is expensive and RTE is facing a €50 million deficit this year. So how is it going to fund all of this? I've been talking to Mike Mullane of the European Broadcasting Union's radio department about what it's doing and how it can help.
One of the easiest places to cut services is in training. And short term, the consequences probably are negligible. There's a lot of potential for on-the-job training in media. But long term, the consequences can be disastrous. We saw that in the aftermath of the David Kelly Iraq scandal that hit the BBC back in 2003, 2004. The BBC carried out an internal review of journalism, and what they discovered was that in order for journalism to function, in order for public service journalism to function, you need to have continuous training. So even your most experienced, your most reliable journalists need to be reminded at regular intervals about the process of verification. They need to be reminded about values. Sometimes it is easy to sort of go on to automatic pilot and to forget about why and how you should be doing things. This really has opened the door for the EBU. We realise that training is very expensive to finance and to build in-house. So what we're trying to do is to plug that gap by providing tailor-made training to all countries and to all broadcasters.
And that was Mike Mullane.
FM 104's entertainment show.
And welcome to Galway Talks.
Now, we do love the wireless in this country, but the days when one station ruled the airwaves are long gone. Gay Byrne regularly pulled in audiences of a million or more for his morning show. And while RTE still produces most of the popular shows, Morning Ireland is the biggest radio show in the country, it is local and independent radio that has the largest slice of the overall market, reaching more than 60% of the country's adults. So we are still listening. More than 85% of us tune into several hours of Irish radio every day. But what is turning us on? I've been talking to Scott Williams of Dublin's Q102, to John McMahon of 2FM, and we'll hear voices from community radio right across the country. But first, Paula Kniff has been inside one local radio station, KCLR in Kilkenny.
We have the squirrel we have.
It's very, very different from national radio because you're one step removed. And, you know, you're not as connected to your audience. But when you do something here in a local radio station, you meet the people, you meet them on the street, and some of them know who you are. And, yeah, you're very accountable. And I think there's an even more acute sense of responsibility with the journalism in a local radio station. You know, when you're working in the radio, you just remember that these people are your neighbours.
So will you come and talk to us about him today, or her, or them?
My name is Catherine Blake and I'm the producer on the Sunon show.
Good morning, it's Sinead at KCLR. How are you?
It means everything to us, you know, the local story. You might think that something is an extremely important issue, and it might be an important issue, but it's not important to the people living locally. What's important to the people living locally is whatever is affecting them on this day.
Hold on, I'll put you on to Catherine.
I'm Sunon, I'm station editor, but what I do every day, of course, is present the Sunon Show, which is a three-hour morning talk show.
Welcome to the Sunon Show here on KCLR.
But what we hope to do is to reflect what's going on in Carlow and Kilkenny, the joys, the sorrows, the ups, the downs, the concerns of people who listen to us. But we also want to entertain people.
Caring for people with Alzheimer's, and
we're fully commercially funded. In that brutal phrase, I don't know where I picked it up, but we eat what we kill. Basically, we're as good as our audience figures. We're as good as our sales team, and we're as good as our programming. So that keeps you very honest. It keeps you very responsive. You have to provide what's working, because on a local basis, if your advertisers aren't getting a result, they don't come back.
But let's start, as we always do, this hour of the morning. With
John Purcell, I'm the Chief Executive of KCLR.
I'm joined in studio by Fiona Canaan.
In common with the vast majority of local radio stations throughout the country, it's the most listened to source of news and information in this area. We cover Carlow and Kilkenny. Our market share is 36%. And just to give people a sense, that's greater than the combined market share of RT1 and 2FM combined. So we're a very popular radio station, and we do that by providing a very broad range of services. We provide local news and information. We provide talk shows. We do special interest programmes. We have arts programmes. We have farming programmes. We have business programmes. We have programmes for people with disabilities. We have programmes from different ethnic minorities and immigrants.
And welcome back, I think.
Local radio has now existed for 20 years outside of Dublin. And just about anywhere has its very own local radio station, which is for its own people. It's not narrow in that it's local, but it looks at everything through that kind of local perspective. So that's what we are.
Lots more to come, including
people that work in local radio achieve a huge amount with quite limited resources in comparison to often other programme outlets, which, you know, on a national basis, you can have quite a considerable programme team often. Whereas you saw the Sue Nunn Show being produced this morning by three people. Sue does her own technical operation at the studio, and that's replicated across the country in independent stations. In national media, often it's pop stars or it's celebrities or it's people who've written books. We bring it down to the local level, and it can be local performers, local issues. You know, it's a political phrase, but I mean, our outlook is we think global and we act locally.
Hello, KCLR 96 FM.
And that was Paula Kniff reporting. Now, Scott Williams runs Dublin's Q102, and he's also chairman of the independent broadcasting body, the IBI, which covers everything from the big companies like Communicorp and UTV to the small, privately owned local stations.
Independent radio has been, I guess, one of the stellar success stories. 1,500 or thereabouts jobs created in the sector. We have extraordinarily high listenership levels. We have a new record, actually. 2.5 million people listening every day. And 7 out of every 10 minutes listened to the radio is to an independent radio station. Now, when I say independent radio station, I mean all the ones that aren't RTE or community, licensed by the BAI. So it includes Today FM, includes News Talk, our station Q102, FM104, and the local radio stations right across the country.
And what is it they're listening to mostly, though? Is it their own local regional stations or is it the national?
Depends ones? On the area. Here in Dublin, RTE Radio 1 is the number one radio station, and its popularity is inversely proportional to the amount of kilometres you travel away from Dublin. The reason for that, I guess, is because localism means different things in different places. For example, Radio Kerry, I would characterise it as they're in the Kerry business, as Cork or in the Cork business and so on. I think that's what people respond to.
Now, we know that revenues, advertising revenues, are falling across the board. So how is commercial radio faring out?
30% down at the peak of the market would be a conservative estimate from the highs of 2007. It's been a struggle. There have been a lot of rationalisations, there have been a lot of redundancies, different changes in work practices and all the rest. But I am delighted to say we haven't had one failure. Nobody has gone out of business. So I think that makes us quite unique compared to all the other businesses that have hit the rocks in recent years. So some of them are hanging on, they find it tough.
Now you're owned by UTV. What else is in that stable?
UTV Media, our Radio Ireland division, is Q102, my own station, also FM 104, Cork's 96 and 103 FM in Cork, Limerick's Live 95, and also LMFM, which is Loudmead but based in Drogheda.
Now, I know that the BAI has taken consultations on radio licences and the renewal of licences. Is there room for more in the market?
No.
None? No, to say children's channels, for instance, well, ethnic radio?
Well, maybe there is. Well, if I were to say to you, do you like jazz music? Yes, I do. Should we have a jazz music station? Well, what a great idea. There's no guarantee you'll listen, and there's no guarantee or certainty that you'll listen often enough to create a viable channel.
Scott Williams, Chief Executive of Q102 and Chairman of the IBI there.
Welcome back to the mothership. John and Edward on Jerry the G-Ride Show. Do an impression of me.
Oh God, let's try.
The latest radio figures suggest that 2FM has lost its way. It's trailing behind Today FM, and even its biggest name, Ryan Tuberty, is an also-ran in the morning radio ratings. John McMahon has been head of 2FM for the past couple of years, and he joins me now. So John, you've got about 7.5% of the audience share. That has got to be a worry.
2FM's maintained its audience share at 7.5%. We've grown 7-day reach and grown weekday reach. The station's been through a huge amount of turmoil, as you know, in the last couple of years. And one book that shows growth across every show from 11 o'clock till midnight, growth at the weekend, is something that I would say is a success.
How big, though, was the loss of Jerry Ryan?
Jerry was a colleague and a friend, as well as everything else. And he broadcast 15 hours a week for 22 years. And he grew a huge audience, incredibly loyal. He was a huge loss to the Irish radio market in general, not just to 2FM. Something like 70 or 80,000 people stopped listening to any radio once Gerry died, which I don't know that any other broadcaster in the country would have had that sort of effect. But 2FM was in the process of change even before Gerry died, and we'd made some significant decisions about the station the year beforehand, and that's a three-year plan. We're about a year and a half into that, and we have to move forward. And yes, we miss him, but that's not what we're focusing on anymore.
Well, Ryan Tuberty hasn't exactly set the airways on fire in the morning, has he?
I think Ryan's doing a really, really good show. I think that the production values of the show, the ideas they come up with, everything that they do on that show, the greet on the streets that they're doing, you'll see the huge appeal that Ryan has. The station certainly has a challenge to make people reevaluate 2FM and to come and tune in again. But I think if they do, they'll be surprised by just how good that show is.
So why is he being walloped by Ray Darcy then?
I firstly don't think he is being walloped by Ray Darcy, but secondly, Ray is doing a very good show. Ray, like Gerry and like all successful radio shows, were given time and they grew organically without pressure. Ryan came into the absolute most focused media spotlight in Ireland when Gerry died. He was brave enough to take it on. This one is a challenge, but it's one he's up to.
And just something that puzzles me and maybe puzzles listeners as well. Why do you let him go to the BBC once a year to give them a dig out?
Well, Ryan isn't an employee. Ryan is an independent contractor. He provides a certain amount of service to RTE every year. In his case, it's about 250 radio shows for us and 37, I think, late, late shows. And that's what he provides for us. When he isn't providing that service, he is not an employee of RTE and he is, in all intents and purposes, an independent contractor and he's free to do things. His contract precludes him from working for other radio broadcasters in this island. BBC is not on this island. It's not a commercial competitor of RTE, certainly in radio terms. So for that reason, that's why he chooses to do what he does.
Are you happy about it?
I would rather that Ryan was as popular as he can be. And I think he can learn huge amounts in the BBC and he brings that back to us. I think sometimes any broadcaster can be overworked. And I worry at all times about presenters if they get fatigue. That's not just Ryan. But Ryan has a boundless energy. And I mean, anyone who's met him in person or seen him, the reason he's stick thin is not because he doesn't eat. It's because he's constantly moving and constantly thinking. So I don't think he's in danger of wear out just yet. But it's something we obviously need to monitor.
Without the funding cushion that you have available to you, you wouldn't be able to afford somebody like Ryan Tuberty. And the possibility is he mightn't survive at all.
I mean, it depends on what year you take. If you take 2FM in the period 2000 to now, in a 10-year period to look at a business, 2FM would be massively in profit without a single penny of licence fee funding. It made a lot of money in the boom times. It has had financial issues, as have all commercial radio stations in the last couple of years and they're ones we're addressing. As everyone knows, RTE is in a fairly serious cost-cutting procedure at the moment. But part of all of RTE's remit is to inform, educate and entertain. And entertain is part of that too. 2FM provides music and entertainment and as far as I'm concerned, that is part of RTE as a commercial and publicly funded broadcast organisation.
And that was John McMahon, the head of 2FM. But outside the public and commercial radio sector, Ireland has a vibrant and growing community radio network. There's 24 community radio stations now, and research shows that over 34% of the available audience is listening. We've been chatting to community radio folk from around the country who are part of CRAIL, a community radio network in Ireland.
The community radio sector has been growing massively in Ireland over the last few years. I'm Dermot McIntyre of Grey Heron Media. We work with CRAIL to support them in the development of the community radio sector.
My name is Sally Galeana and I work with Near FM. We are very ambitious and we want to actually do more for the community.
My name is Bernie O'Callaghan, Southwest Donegal Community Radio. I'm the station manager. We do discussion shows. We have a midweek show which discusses political issues, local issues, issues that are of interest to the general population.
My name is Maurice O'Finochta. I'm the station manager with Radio Na Lifa, 106.4 FM. We're actually one of the oldest community radio stations. Obviously, we have RTE Radio Na Gaeltachta, which has been broadcasting since 1972. Whereas Radio Na Lifa, broadcasting now for almost 20 years, is very much aimed at giving people who speak Irish but who live in Dublin a voice and a service that covers contemporary issues, city life, city culture.
I would describe community radio as a very powerful tool for self-expression from members of the community, but also it gives a chance to people whose voices aren't heard normally. My name is Aidan Long and I'm the manager in Claremorris Community Radio, but I also sit on the coordinating committee of CRAIL.
So we're empowering people to have their voices heard. But a critical part of that, then is that those discussions are heard by people. So listenership in that context is almost the final part of the empowerment process.
We look to serve all of the community. So we have programming from school children right up to the elderly or the active age. My name is Mary Lennon and I'm manager with Athlone Community Radio. We're very lucky. We got funding from Bubble under the Community Services Programme.
We do an awful lot of work in community outreach with people from disadvantaged backgrounds and people with disabilities. I think that's the real power of community radio. And of course, it gives a voice back to all sections of society and not the ones we're used to hearing, I suppose, in mainstream or commercial media.
Now, this week's Media Watch comes from Brian Peelan in Belfast.
I started in the Sunday News in Belfast in 1984 and crisscrossed my way through a series of titles in the UK and the Republic, including the late lamented Irish Press Group. I'm now the editor of View, a free online publication for the community voluntary sector in Northern Ireland. My personal journalism, in many ways, mirrors the decline of the print industry and the rise of online journalism. But as many local publications strive to make a living against a difficult economic background, the questions are the same. How do you entice people to read your product? And how do you make money out of the internet when so much of the content is free? The Belfast Telegraph, the Irish News and the Newsletter are all facing the same challenges as they try to stem a decline in readers. I opted for online journalism after my job as a sub-editor with the Belfast Telegraph was outsourced. It was a case of step out of the crowd at 55 years of age and see if my partner, Una Murphy, and I could set up an online media business. We are passionate about local journalists producing quality publications. The community voluntary sector seems to like our concept and the paid adverts have kept us viable. For View to survive and grow, we have to appeal to the 100,000 people who work in the voluntary community sector. Many of these organisations are crying out for their stories to be told.
Brian Peelan in Belfast. I'm Brenda Power and you've been listening to The Media Show. Coming up next week, we're inside the Longford Leader, and we'll be talking digital media and kids. And don't forget, podcasts of all 5 shows in the series are available, as well as full interviews, on rte.ie/radio1/The Media Show.